This podcast discusses domestic violence, criminal behavior, murder, and adult themes. While not explicit, listener discretion is advised. Fumes pumped out of the tailpipe of the idling cab. Dirty road slush coated the curbs outside of the West Valley City Police headquarters. Josh Powell approached the taxi through the darkness. He opened the passenger door, slumped into the seat, and told the driver to take him to Salt Lake City International Airport. It was about 10 p.m. on the night of Tuesday, December 8th, 2009. Josh had just been grilled for nearly 4 hours by Detective Ellis Maxwell about the disappearance of his wife, Susan, the day before.
He left his kids with his mom and sister. When I reached out to them that evening and that following day, they didn't know where he was and heard from him.
The ride to the airport didn't take long. When the cab reached the terminal, Josh stepped out again into the sub-freezing cold. Roller wheels on suitcases clattered over the pebble-like pavement as airline passengers scurried through sliding doors to check their bags and board red-eye flights.
Your attention, please. Terminal 1 and Terminal 2 curb areas are for loading and unloading purposes only. No parking or waiting is allowed.
Josh didn't have any luggage. He wasn't headed to an airplane. As the cab pulled away from the curb, he walked over to the parking garage across from the terminals. He approached the Hertz rental car counter and pulled out a credit card. Josh left the airport in a silver Ford Focus. What he did next will probably never be known for sure. But he didn't go home. Police were still there, serving a search warrant. And Josh knew it.
When I was in the interview, they authored a search warrant for the house, search warrant for the vehicle, and then to put the tracker on his minivan. You know, there was enough evidence there and suspicion, right? Reasonable suspicion that we could secure these just based off of, you know, his lack of statements, his story, Susan not having any criminal history, no past of running off and abandoning your family. So you got a lot of stuff like that that can support the reasonable suspicion, but you don't have the probable cause to put the guy into jail. And that's the challenge.
This is Cold, Episode 6, Josh in the Wind. I'm Dave Colley.
Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
You can power up your playtime with the Nintendo Switch system, the home of Mario and friends. You may discover exciting surprises with Mario, Princess Peach, and more in Super Mario Bros. Wonder. Or challenge friends to a race in Mario Kart 8 Deluxe. You can head to Nintendo.com to learn more about the Nintendo Switch system. Games and systems sold separately.
On the morning of Wednesday, December 9th, 2009, day 3 of the search for Susan, Detective Ellis Maxwell met two colleagues at Salt Lake City International Airport. They weren't there to look for Josh's rental car because at that point, they didn't know he had it. It was coincidence that they were at the airport. They were going to the hangar where the Utah Department of Public Safety kept its helicopters. The weather that day was perfect for flying. Blue skies with just a bit of high cloud. The chopper climbed into the brisk winter air, blades thrumming as it cruised south across the Salt Lake Valley. At the tip of the Ochre Mountains, the helicopter banked to the right and descended, dropping to follow Utah State Route 73 over Five Mile Pass. From that point on, the detectives were skimming just 500 feet above the Pony Express Trail, where Josh claimed to have gone camping in the middle of a snowstorm two nights prior. Josh had said his campsite was off to the side of the trail, about 20 miles from the end of the pavement.
He claimed he had a fire out there, so I was hopeful that I could find that black spot where he had this fire to corroborate his story and to get a general idea where he was at, because that West Desert is very vast.
The detectives could see tire tracks on the snow-packed trail, but none of them appeared to leave the road. Rotor Wash kicked up a fine mist of snow as the helicopter's skids touched the ground at Simpson Springs. That was the one specific place Josh had mentioned visiting. The detectives checked the old Pony Express station building there, but it was empty. They walked through the campsites, all of which were vacant. They even peeked into the pit toilets. Ugh. Everything was as it should have been. No sign of Susan. So the chopper lifted off again. They flew all the way out to Fish Springs, another 35 miles distant. Still, no suspicious tracks, no sign of a recent campfire. But on the return flight, they spotted something moving on the ground, just a few miles away from Simpson Springs.
But as what we found is the sheep herder in this sheep camp. And we landed the helicopter and we approached the individual, and he did corroborate that Josh was out there. We didn't ask him any leading questions, and he said that, you know, he did see a blue minivan and occupied by a white male, and he didn't know if there was, he couldn't see that there was anybody else in there. And, you know, so we did support and corroborate that he was out there.
Ellis had no reason to doubt it. In fact, Josh had actually made a point of mentioning these sheep during his interviews.
I had a bunch of sheep. Apparently they were herding them. The dog was herding them. Some kind of a big dog. We had to wait for those to get off the road. It was pretty cool.
He wanted me to know that he saw the sheep herder. And these sheep interrupted his travel, right? And he was kind of stuck on that for a minute. And I took that two ways. One, I took it like, okay, this guy's got some ADHD issues or something. Like he gets stuck on something and he's on it, right? Or, you know, stepping outside of the box in that situation, it's like, well, he wanted me to know that.
But why would Josh have wanted to give away such a detail?
That's his truth, right? He wanted us to verify that he was out there.
Meantime, back in West Valley, Ellis's supervisors were taking stock of the case. They met with the Salt Lake County District Attorney's Office and talked about what they'd seized from the house on Tuesday night. It became clear there were other pieces of possible evidence that had been left behind, like most of everything that had been in the back of Josh's minivan when he came back from the Pony Express Trail on Monday. The police would have to go back to the house with a second warrant. The DA also went to a judge and received permission to conduct an investigation. Basically, it meant prosecutors gained the power to issue subpoenas, which they used to go after Josh and Susan's financial, medical, and phone records. The court swore the investigators to secrecy.
We moved to seal all of these affidavits and the subpoenas. Everything that we would collect was sealed under a court order.
Ellis told me there was a real risk Josh would find out what they were doing, what they knew, and take steps to cover his tracks. That risk only grew once the news media got wind of the story.
West Valley City Police say Josh's parents called them for help when both he and Susan missed work on Monday. The children didn't show up to daycare.
The first reports about Susan's disappearance appeared late Tuesday. The story gained real traction on Wednesday. West Valley Police Captain Tom McLaughlin told reporters they had no suspects.
Is he a suspect? No, he is not a suspect.
Is he a person of interest?
We have many people we are interested in.
But the secret warrant affidavits and subpoenas told a very different story. Josh was absolutely a suspect. That afternoon, West Valley detectives returned to the Powell family home with their new search warrant. They streamed through the front door shouting, "Police!" and ordering anybody who might be inside to identify themselves. There was no need. The house was empty. They took Josh's generator, gas can, humidifier, folding saw, circular saw, razor box cutter, two sleds, the tote of camping supplies and hand tools, the nitrile gloves, all the rest of that stuff that had been in the minivan on Monday. They took more digital media too, hard drives, a thumb drive, an SD card, as well as Susan's checkbook. But where was Josh while all of this was happening? He hadn't talked to the police since late the night before. His sister, Jennifer Graves, wondered when he might arrive at her house to pick up his sons. He'd left them in her care when he went to meet with police on Tuesday morning, more than 24 hours before.
And so I just continued to expect a phone call letting us know that he was coming or just him showing up. Honestly, I was dreading it. I really didn't want him to come back and take the boys. I wanted the boys to stay here with us and felt like that was the safest place for them.
But Josh hadn't gone to Jennifer's house after leaving the police station and renting the car on Tuesday night.
It was finally the next day that Josh said something about driving past our house at like 1:30 in the morning or something and saying, "Well, I didn't want to bother you guys and, you know, get you up," and my light was on. I was not sleeping. And it would have been obvious because my room is on the front of the house. So if he had actually really, in fact, driven by, he would have known.
Josh's disappearing act concerned Ellis. He called Josh's mom, Teresa, at about 4 on Wednesday afternoon to ask if she had heard from him. And she said no.
Eventually, he establishes contact with Teresa, and she calls me, and I get his new phone number. I call him, and he's in Tremont, Utah. And it's a fight with him over the phone to get him to come back to the police department.
Tremont in Utah sits about 80 miles north of West Valley City, right on the fastest route between West Valley and Josh's dad's house in South Hill, Washington. While in Tremont, Josh activated a new cell phone. That was roughly 18 hours after he left the airport with the rental car on Tuesday night. To this day, no one can say where he was or what he was doing during those 18 hours. Josh told Jennifer he'd driven laps around Salt Lake City, getting off and on the freeways at random. And in fact, Josh was still on the road when Ellis called him, telling him to come pick up his minivan.
He says he doesn't trust me, I'm going to arrest him, and so I've got to go through this dog and pony show with him and convince him, look, I'm not going to arrest you, I'm not taking you to jail. If you didn't do anything wrong, why do you have this guilty conscience? Get back here and get your van, otherwise I'm going to tow it. And I shared that with him because I know to this point that he, you know, he doesn't like to spend money on things that he doesn't want to spend money on. He'll spend money on acetylene torches and generators and stuff like bipolar stuff, right? Bipolar purchasing. But he was really upset we broke his window. He was more upset that we broke his window into his house than his wife missing.
Josh remained reluctant. Phone records would later show he drove past Susan's work just as if he were there to pick her up after her shift. Then he drove past his own work, from which he'd been absent without leave for 3 straight days. Then he went home. He called his dad and spent about an hour on the phone with him. Steve Powell, like his oldest son, had dropped from view after Susan's disappearance. Phone records showed he'd been in Washington that day. Then he'd called in sick from work on Tuesday and Wednesday. Steve worked for Washington Correctional Industries, selling furniture built by inmates. He spent a lot of his time on the road, usually alone, and didn't have any close friends in the organization. His phone records later revealed he did remain in Washington on those 2 days, but there was a gap of time during the same period when Josh was missing with a rental car. When Josh finished talking to his dad on Wednesday evening, he made his way over to West Valley Police Headquarters.
Eventually he does. He shows up. He gets his van on his time. I think it was like 7 o'clock at night. Mm-hmm. I was so upset because it was my daughter's birthday, right? Yeah, he would interrupt everybody else's lives.
Ellis gave Josh the keys. Josh locked the minivan's doors, then went back to his rental car. That's when Ellis first found out about the Ford Focus.
And that's when we learn, you know, we get the plate off the rental car and we follow up with it. And okay, this is going to be our break, right? Now. And that's this whole story, man. No breaks. Anytime you think you might have something, nada.
More on the rental car in just a minute. First, Ellis asked Josh if he'd be willing to come in and take a CVSA test. That's an acronym for Computer Voice Stress Analyzer. It's a kind of lie detector. Josh said, yeah, he'd think about it. The next day, he told Ellis he'd do it. He would come in for the CVSA on Monday, December 14th, exactly 1 week after Susan's disappearance. Josh finally returned home Wednesday evening, only to find TV news crews camped out in his cul-de-sac.
This afternoon, West Valley Police served a search warrant at Susan Powell's home because that was the last place anyone saw her.
He'd only had a few hours sleep since Sunday and was in no shape to face cameras. So he slipped over to the home of his neighbors, Tim and Crystal Peterson. It was an odd choice. The Petersons were well aware of the troubles in Josh and Susan's marriage. A few months earlier, Susan had asked Crystal in a Facebook message if Tim might be willing to speak with Josh about his faltering faith.
I suggested if he did it through service, then my husband would be more willing to listen.
She suggested Tim spend some guy time with Josh, helping him rebuild their deck or finish their basement.
Everyone else at church has no clue how to interact with Josh and assume he hates the church. And I guess it's not that, really. It's just that it's not convenient for him to attend it or be encouraging to me and the boys, and obviously, very weak faith at the moment.
Susan had also confided in Tim. In an email, she had told him she was giving Josh until the end of the year to go back to church. Josh had until April to obtain a temple recommend. That's a card that essentially shows Latter-day Saints are following their church's teachings. So it seemed surreal for Tim to find Josh in his living room that Wednesday evening in December.
And, he's rubbing lotion on his hands because his hands are just windburnt. And he's talking about how he had to buy new shoes. And, you're wearing the same shoes that I am.
Josh complained about the missing carpet in his living room and the odd odor left behind from the blood-detecting chemicals. He wondered if the fumes would kill his pet parrot. He didn't seem at all concerned about where Susan might be.
And he wasn't asking any of those questions at all. He was just sitting there like a turd on my couch.
Josh asked Tim for a ride over to police headquarters so he could pick up his minivan. As they sat in the cab of Tim's truck, Tim asked Josh what he'd done with Susan. Josh didn't answer.
I asked one more time, and I asked about as plain as I possibly could, and I said, "Damn it, Josh, you tell me, where the hell is Susan right now?" And he said, "The police will find her." And that's when I said, "I don't like you no more. You are my enemy."
Susan's friends, too, were finding it hard to give Josh the benefit of the doubt. They knew all too well how poorly he had treated Susan. Here's Amber Hardman, one of Susan's closest work friends.
I mean, I'd even sit and we'd have conversations and trying to figure out ways she could leave. Like, she was so worried he would track her down no matter what she did. And that would be the first thing she said. I can't. No matter where I go, what I do, he will find me. That was all she could think about. It was like she had no way out. And I was like, he doesn't know where we live. What if he came to our house and we found somewhere for you to go in another state? He would not know. She's like, no, he will figure it out. He will find me.
Stories like those only underlined the sense of urgency for police. Ellis was starting to grasp the enormity of the task ahead as he considered an all-out search of the vast West Desert. That job started at sunrise on Thursday. More than 20 investigators rolled into Simpson Springs, bringing with them ATVs and four-wheel drive trucks. They brought dogs, the department's lumbering mobile command unit, a huge RV, even braved the icy Pony Express Trail Road. They fanned out from Simpson Springs, looking for the spot where Josh had made camp on Sunday night. A few of them even drove 30 miles farther down the Pony Express Trail to the Dugway geode beds. That's a popular rock hounding site Josh, Susan, and the boys had visited earlier in the year. That is where they found nothing. Josh was getting a crash course in dealing with the media. SUVs wrapped in TV station logos stalked the streets. KUTV reporter Chris Jones even ambushed Josh as he stopped by his sister Jennifer's house in West Jordan on Thursday. In the video, Josh looked frazzled and sleep-deprived. He struggled to answer basic questions. While Josh was avoiding the news cameras, Susan's friends were doing their best to fill the void. Kiersey Helliwell found herself thrust into the spotlight.
I mean, I was so surprised the first day that someone knocked on my door and was sitting there with the camera. I was like, what in the world? Who sent you here? Oh, well, Susan's neighbors said that you were a good one to talk to because you knew what was going on. And that was the start of it.
People began to bombard Kiersey as Susan's story spread through the news. They called, texted, and sent her messages on Facebook, hungry for information.
So yeah, somebody said to me within the first couple days, you guys need to have a candlelight vigil. It's super important that you get the media involved and you plan events that they will come to keep her name out there to get as many people looking for her as possible. And I was completely clueless. I had no idea.
Kiersey rose to the task, helping organize a vigil on Thursday night at West Valley City's Centennial Park.
And I was like, okay, what do you do at a candlelight vigil? I've never been to one. I don't know. I don't know how to plan this. And so we'd planned it, and Josh showed up at it, but he didn't talk to us. He didn't talk to me. So I just caught a glimpse of him in the crowd and the kids, and he kept them away from me.
Josh's arrival caused the crowd to buzz like a plucked guitar string. Giovanna Owings, the last person besides Josh to have seen Susan alive, could sense it.
The other people there weren't as inclusive of him, just because I believe by that point they were starting to suspect that he knew more than he was saying about Susan's disappearance.
Dax Guzman, a neighbor who Josh had hired to help rebuild his deck, sensed it as well.
The way people were looking at him, you know, people knew. You know, just because you can't prove something doesn't mean you don't know it.
Josh's brother Michael was with him, having apparently come down from Washington. Debbie Caldwell, the daycare provider who had first sounded the alarm about the family's disappearance on Monday, noticed neither Josh nor Michael had bothered to put gloves on Charlie or Braden's hands.
When I was talking to Charlie and putting gloves on his hands, and he seen me talking to Charlie, and he hurried up and ran over and scooped him up.
So he couldn't talk to you and
so
tell you
So he couldn't
anything.
Talk to me and tell me anything. And he said, we're not going to be coming back to daycare because, you know, with everything that's going on. And I said, well, Josh, you have to work. Why would that make a difference? And he says, oh, well, my family's going to have to take care of the boys. It was very odd.
Reporters gave chase as Josh moved through the crowd.
Can you just tell us anything at all?
Please, can we have you give me some space?
They tried to ask him questions, but he mostly ignored them.
Josh, you said that you had gone camping. Is that right? A lot of people just want to know, you know, what you know about her disappearance. Can you tell us?
I'm going to take off.
As the vigil wound down, Josh loaded the boys into their car seats. He groused about the news crews who were staking out his house, doing live reports from his front lawn. So Kiersey suggested he bring the boys to her place instead. The Josh Powell who showed up at Kiersey's house that night wasn't the man she knew. He wasn't loud, opinionated, or overbearing. Instead, he spoke in broken sentences, stumbling over his words. He made odd comments, like saying he expected to see Susan standing at a bus stop. At one point, Charlie opened his mouth and started to say, "I hate my daddy because..." Mortified, Kiersey cut him off. Then, she looked up at Josh. He stood behind his son, stiff and red-faced, but didn't say a word. The next morning, the GPS beacon Ellis had hidden on Josh's minivan sent out an alert. It was moving, going west on Interstate 80.
I think everybody that was involved in the investigation up to that point was somewhat excited, I guess. I mean, because why is he going out west? Why is he just out of the clear blue driving out west on I-80?
Detectives raced to their cars. Right away, Ellis noticed something odd.
He would clean himself.
He's not talking about soap. This is counter-espionage lingo.
He would be driving down I-80, and he would just take an exit. So he would get off, say, at Clive. And then he'd turn around and go back the other way, take the exit, get off, go around. I mean, he would get on and off the freeway, you know, see if somebody was tailing him.
What Josh didn't realize is West Valley police had called in help from the DEA, which put an airplane into the sky to watch him from above. The detectives kept their distance as Josh drove out past the last fringes of the city.
From there all the way out to Wendover, Nevada, it's straight salt flats. There's nothing out there. There are exits here and there, but there's really nothing to go visit.
Josh's minivan cruised across the salt flats, past the famous Bonneville Speedway racecourse, and into the casino town of West Wendover, Nevada. He drove to the far side of Wendover and parked outside of a Smith's grocery store. It didn't make much sense. But maybe he was there to use a payphone or a burner cell phone the police didn't know about. He stayed there for about 20 minutes, then returned to the freeway and headed back east. After about 30 eastbound miles, Josh took an exit at Clive. It's a desolate spot, far from anywhere. The minivan rolled to a stop in a quarry on the north side of the interstate. Josh stayed there for about 2 hours.
I think he personally did it to see if we were going to follow him, if we had eyes on him. I think it was kind of one of his things to say, okay, let's see what the cops do and if they are going to follow me.
After Josh finally left, a detective managed to get a glimpse into the minivan. It appeared that Josh wasn't alone, that maybe someone was with him in the front passenger seat. Question was, who? It wasn't clear. The detectives monitored Josh's movements as he drove all the way back to Salt Lake City and to the office of defense attorney Scott Williams. They broke off their tail and raced to the gravel pit.
That was a little exciting. As soon as he left, you know, obviously we sent some guys over to kind of check it out. There was fresh snow on the ground, so we could see where he had walked and stuff like that. And, you know, we searched that entire area. And we used specialized dogs as well.
The dogs sniffed around but didn't find anything. It's worth noting, about 2 months later, when the weather was warmer, the police returned with 9 dogs. 4 of them showed interest at a single spot within the Clive gravel pit. It was not a gravesite, but the investigators reasoned it might have been a place where somebody had bled. Was that person Susan? They couldn't say. Tips flooded the West Valley City Police Department as news coverage of the case continued to crescendo. Detectives learned about Josh's spending spree, how he had dropped hundreds of dollars on an acetylene torch the day before Thanksgiving. They heard from the nursery worker who had advised Josh not to buy a roll of plastic tree wrap because it wouldn't help him mend a broken branch. Both of those purchases were suspicious in retrospect. As detectives were tailing Josh to and from Wendover on Friday, others chased down these new leads. They headed to the airport with the license plate number for the Ford Focus Josh had rented, only to learn it had been rented out again. The rental company's paperwork, though, showed Josh had put 807 miles on the car. Cut that number in half, and you have a radius of just over 400 miles. That was the absolute farthest Josh could have driven and come directly back from the parking garage at Salt Lake City International Airport. If you take a map and draw a circle centered on the airport with that radius, it covers an area of more than 500,000 square miles. It's nearly twice the size of the state of Texas. The circle would stretch almost from Phoenix, Arizona to Helena, Montana, or from Denver, Colorado to Reno, Nevada. In other words, the area Josh could have visited during his missing 18 hours was immense. But police did have areas of particular focus. Susan's work friend, Amber Hardman, told detectives Josh had once said he knew where to hide a body, were he ever to commit a murder. His solution was to dump it in an abandoned mine. A pair of detectives started probing abandoned mines just 9 days into the investigation. Their effort blossomed into an operation that spanned more than a year and covered hundreds of sites. You'll hear much more about those mine searches in the next episode. Giovanna Owings spotted Josh at church on Sunday, exactly 1 week since she became the last person besides him to see Susan alive.
And he had the boys with him.
Giovanna told Josh he ought to bring the boys back to daycare to give them a sense of normalcy.
He said he'd think about it. That's all he said.
Their daycare provider, Debbie Caldwell, was also a member of Susan's religion.
Sunday, and I was at church, and we had sung a hymn in church, and I simply heard in my head, "You will see her again." But it was more of a spiritual prompting telling me this, and I literally just broke down and just started sobbing. And they had to go get my husband to bring him in to me. And he's like, "So you know," I knew that at that point in time that she was no longer here. She was a spirit.
Susan's father, Chuck Cox, arrived in Utah from his home in Washington State.
Jennifer Stagg spoke with them here at the KSL studios tonight. Jen, how's he holding up?
Keith and Denny, Charles Cox is frustrated and heartbroken over Susan's disappearance. He flew into Salt Lake City tonight from his home in Washington to meet with police and all of Susan's friends who are praying for her safe return.
Linda Bagley and some of Susan's other work friends introduced themselves to Chuck at a gathering. They explained how they had led detectives to Susan's secret files.
Pulled him aside and we talked to him and let him know that we've got this journal, that she had this journal and that it did get to the police and everything. And he seemed to not know about the journal, but so we thanked us and everything. But.
On Monday, Josh failed to show up for his lie detector appointment with Ellis.
He wasn't going to do it. His lawyer had told him, encouraged him not to.
West Valley police were keeping eyes on Josh. Josh went to Debbie's daycare and picked up all of Charlie and Braden's things. He told Debbie they wouldn't be coming back. The next day, Josh called Susan's chiropractor and canceled all of her future appointments. Then he went back to West Valley Police Headquarters with his new defense attorney, Scott Williams.
This is your last chance to save 65% on a full year of BODi. I'm Carl, co-founder of BODi. That's B-O-D-I. And I want to help you lean into your decision to start working out and eating better. Right now, if you sign up for a one-year subscription to BODi, I'll give you 65% off. Look, I know it's not easy to get fit and lose weight, especially if you're trying to figure it out by yourself. But we make it simple. Just follow a program for 20 to 30 minutes day by day and lose 5 to 10 pounds a month. We have over 120 120 programs that have been tested and proven to work, and almost 300,000 five-star reviews in the App Store to prove it. Body also has complete eating plans and thousands of healthy, delicious recipes. So stop guessing and start seeing results with Body. And let me give you 65% off right now so you save big on the app that CNN underscored named Best Fitness App. But the sale ends this week, so don't wait. Sign up for a year of Body and save 65%. Just go to body.com. That's B-O-D-I with an I.com.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling t-shirts from a booth at your local farmer's market or dishing out handmade crafts online, Shopify's POS system manages it all. Unite your in-person and online business with a trusted platform that supports your retail hustle. Get started with hardware tailored to your needs, from payments on the go to full-scale retail setups, with round-the-clock support to keep your sales smooth as silk. Do the smart thing for retail. Go with Shopify. For a limited time, sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/wondery, all lowercase. Take your business to new heights. Visit shopify.com/wondery today. That's shopify.com/wondery.
Audible is the destination for thrilling audio entertainment with highly anticipated new releases. The time is now more than ever to embrace the breathtaking, sinister, and shocking tales that can enthrall you, especially with brand new exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors who are guaranteed to keep you gripped, like Amy Tintera's Listen for the Lie. With exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors, captivating sound design, and dynamic performances, Audible brings these stories to life like never before. And as a member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500.
Josh had no choice but to return because Ellis had a new warrant. This time for his blood. While they set up for the blood draw, Williams told Ellis he wanted to make sure police weren't spreading rumors about his client not being cooperative. Ellis asked Williams about having him take the lie detector test.
Yeah, I'm sure I know what your answer is on that. But
yeah. But you gotta ask.
Absolutely. So
we're still talking.
Josh never did take that test. But the recording of the blood draw was interesting in its own right. It showed Josh was very, very tense.
You'll be okay because your veins are sucking up. Like they're, as soon as I touch them, you're a little bit nervous.
Breathe.
You just need to breathe and relax, okay?
Just relax.
Man. Yeah, just relax.
Like taking blood, just like going to the blood bank.
Just relax, there you go.
Josh walked out of the police station yet again that day. A free man. The media attention continued to intensify.
After days of denying Josh Powell as a person of interest in the disappearance of his wife, police now say he is. Thanks for joining us.
Josh turned to his neighbors, Bernard and Betty Trujillo, who lived a couple of doors away in Sarah Circle. The Trujillos had once been Latter-day Saints, but had changed churches. Josh had at times confided in them about his own conflicted feelings regarding his church. Bernard and Betty's daughter, Wendy, had given birth to a daughter around the same time Susan had Charlie.
And they were kind of close, so we would both walk our kids in strollers through the neighborhood after. And it was interesting because we seemed to go out near the same time to walk around, so we'd pass each other with our strollers and just, oh, hi.
One night, after Susan disappeared, Wendy heard Josh complaining that he hadn't even had dinner the night before because of the media. She invited Josh and his brother Michael over for dinner with her family. As they ate, Josh thanked Wendy for not judging him, as he felt others in the neighborhood had.
But I had reminded him, I says, well, you know, there's a verse in the Bible that tells you not to judge. And I says, because you're going to be judged by God when you go there. And he's the one that gets to judge you, not us. And he's the one that's going to decide what happens with you. He's your judge. And he just got this really deep look, swallowed really hard, and was like, kind of nodded his head and looked down at the floor, and the whole room got silent. And after he left, my dad was like, what did you say to him? He's like, that was weird. He goes, it got all silent, and he looked like something was wrong.
At that moment, Wendy suspected Josh knew something. Detectives kept busy. They finally got a hold of the rental car. They didn't find any blood in it, but did see a brown Crayola crayon and a small silver handle, like from a toilet tank, in the trunk. They also spotted a quarter and a small tan-colored rock beneath the trunk carpet next to the spare tire. It was unlikely the crayon was a murder weapon, but the investigators took it anyway, and the rest as possible evidence. They served subpoenas at Josh's work, from which he had just been fired, and at the Wells Fargo Bank branch near Susan's office. They found Susan's safe deposit box. It was a gold mine. The box contained Susan's handwritten will, in which she said if anything ever happened to her, Josh was probably responsible. It also held financial documents, $500 in U.S. savings bonds, and the DVD Susan had made showing her assets.
Hope everything works out and we're all happy and live happily ever after as much as that's possible.
Susan's divorce prep was proof of her fears. Ellis and the team kept talking to Susan's coworkers, both past and present. Several shared stories about her recent bout of unexplained nausea. Coworker Amber Hardman said she'd told Susan to get a blood test. It had been a month since Susan's blood draw. The police went to the hospital lab, hoping they might still have her sample on hand, but it had been discarded. Ellis needed a good sample of Susan's DNA. The only other good place to get it was at the house. So West Valley Police went back to the Sarah Circle house early on the afternoon of Thursday, December 17th, with yet another warrant, their third for the house. Josh's younger brother Michael answered the door and said Josh wasn't home. Ellis said they were coming inside. He didn't ask, and told Michael he was free to leave. Michael chose to stay. He was babysitting Charlie and Braden. He ushered the boys into a back bedroom where they remained as the cops poured in, flanked by forensic specialists. The house looked a lot different than it had 10 days earlier when Ellis had first walked through it. Clothing and trash were scattered about as if the only person who'd been picking up the clutter was no longer around. The police went into the master bath and found Susan's hairbrush and toothbrush, both items likely to hold her DNA. A pile of papers and unopened mail sat on the bed in the master bedroom. One of the detectives noticed a Comcast phone bill in Josh's name at the top of the stack. This was an unexpected break, an opportunity to see who Josh had been speaking with without having to pry it out of the phone company. In spite of having been through the house with warrants twice before, they continued to find computers, hard drives, and memory cards. They took two laptops from the bedroom and even found Josh's new cell phone, the one he'd activated in Tremonton. They found the acetylene torch Josh had bought the day before Thanksgiving on a cart in the garage. They took it. They also took attachments for the rug doctor that were tucked away in the basement. They'd apparently missed those during the earlier searches. The working theory at that point was Josh had somehow poisoned Susan. It would have explained her mysterious illness, as well as her drowsiness after eating the pancakes Josh had made her for lunch on Sunday, December 6th. Detectives went to the medicine cabinet in the kitchen pantry. It held 6 full shelves of dietary supplements. Susan was big on homeopathic remedies. She drank probiotic shakes and swallowed handfuls of vitamin capsules every day. The police pulled out papaya enzyme, cod liver oil, omega-3, calcium, magnesium, chlorophyll, vitamins A, C, and D, echinacea, black walnut husk, colloidal silver, sage, yarrow, oregano, and more. There was even a brown glass bottle with a handwritten label that read, "Anti-plague." But in the middle of all of these supplements were 2 green plastic prescription bottles. One was labeled phenazopyridine, and the other cyclobenzaprine. The first bottle was all but empty, with just 3 pills inside. On the other hand, the cyclobenzaprine bottle contained 32 white, round, 5-milligram tablets. I reached out to Dr. Barbara Inslee Crouch for information about these two drugs. She is executive director of the Utah Poison Control Center. She said it's hard to draw any firm conclusions just from knowing Susan had felt nausea.
That's a pretty common thing with any medication, and you take more than you're supposed to.
Earlier in 2009, both Josh and Susan had dealt with urinary tract infections. That's where the phenazepiridine, also known as pyridium, came from. An overdose of phenazepiridine could lead to some interesting symptoms, like red or orange-colored sweat. The other drug, cyclobenzaprine, goes by the brand name Flexeril. It's usually prescribed for back pain and is classified as a muscle relaxant. It doesn't actually relax muscles, though. It's more of a sedative meant to get people off of their feet. A doctor at Granger Medical Clinic in West Valley City had prescribed the cyclobenzaprine to Josh after another driver crashed into the back of his minivan on September 2nd of 2009. Josh had complained of whiplash. I asked Dr. Crouch if a large enough dose of cyclobenzaprine could kill a person.
It would require a whole heck of a lot, or in combination with something else that depresses the central nervous system, and then, you know, they sort of were left alone and not found. It's potential that it could be lethal. I don't want to say it's not a lethal medication.
Ultimately, Dr. Crouch said neither medication seemed a likely cause of a fatal overdose.
Most of these situations are not going to put somebody out and immediately cause a fatality. So, you know, if they were found within a period of time, there's reasonable care that can be provided to reverse the effects of those medications.
After that car crash in September, Josh had used his neck and back pain to justify buying a massage chair. You might remember I made brief mention of that in episode 3. I didn't tell you the whole story. What I'm about to explain has never been reported before. Police didn't know about it. This is brand new and I believe relevant information uncovered as part of my investigation. Josh Powell told his auto insurance company, American Family, on the day of the crash that he had been rear-ended on Bangor Highway in West Valley City. He snapped some pictures of the damage, which was pretty minor. The tailgate on the minivan was dented, but that was about the worst of it. The airbags didn't even deploy. He did not report the crash to law enforcement. Josh went to the clinic, got that prescription, and started seeing a chiropractor for his neck and back pain. For some reason, he didn't use the same chiropractor Susan was already seeing. Josh billed all of this to his auto insurance as a personal injury claim connected to the low-speed crash. As such, it didn't end up on his health insurance, which West Valley Police later reviewed. More than 3 months went by. Susan disappeared. Then, on December 17th of 2009, as police were puzzling over the prescription pill bottles in his house, Josh showed up at Meyer & Marsh Professional Therapies in West Valley City. He complained again of pain from the crash. This time, though, the pain was in his shoulder. An examination revealed Josh had a rotator cuff strain, possibly even a partial tear. Dr. Peter Chalmers with University of Utah Health is an expert on shoulder injuries. In fact, it's his specialty. He said it would have been very unusual to have a low-speed rear-end car crash cause a rotator cuff strain and for that pain to not present for 3 months.
It's really, really, really uncommon from that mechanism. In fact, when I see on my schedule a rotator cuff injury and the mechanism is a motor vehicle accident, my first thought is that the motor vehicle accident has caused some whiplash and maybe a pinched nerve in the neck that's causing some shoulder pain that's been misdiagnosed as a rotator cuff injury.
Dr. Chalmers said it's far more likely for rotator cuff injuries in younger people, like Josh, to come from major traumas.
And by major traumas, I usually mean, you know, like I crashed my helicopter or, right, I fell off of a cornice skiing. It's less commonly with minor things because in younger individuals, the tendon is quite strong.
How did Josh injure his shoulder? Susan weighed about 130 pounds. Josh lived a very sedentary lifestyle and was not in great shape. Might he have overexerted himself, perhaps attempting to lift or drag Susan's body? And how would he have managed caring for his kids after the injury?
And certainly with someone who has a two-year-old, I mean, that's someone who wants to be picked up all the time. And having a rotator cuff injury can make that really difficult, because like getting it into and out of the bath and getting it into and out of the crib and getting into and out of a high chair, that kind of thing is really hard if you have a rotator cuff injury.
Now, Josh can sometimes be seen carrying one of the boys in the weeks following Susan's disappearance. But he also left Charlie and Braden with family members, including his older sister Jennifer and younger brother Michael, for extended periods during that same stretch. Unfortunately, there's no way to know just how bad Josh's shoulder injury was, or if it was even properly diagnosed, without more detailed records. I wanted to get those, but medical records are private and protected by federal law even after a patient's death. Susan's dad, Chuck Cox, has legal authority over Josh's estate through the trust that Josh and Susan formed in early 2009. His attorney, Ann Bremner, made a request for the records, but was told they'd been destroyed after 7 years, as allowed by Utah law. If anyone still has a copy, perhaps American Family Insurance kept one, for instance, I would love to see it. I imagine West Valley City Police might as well. On the same day as his visit to that physical therapist, Josh took the power of attorney he had made Susan sign the prior February to her work. He demanded they transfer the entire balance of her retirement into his direct deposit account. Josh may have lost his wife, but he did not intend to lose her money. Susan's neighbor and friend, Kiersey Helliwell, could not shake a feeling of dread.
I just felt nauseous all week. I couldn't sleep. I couldn't eat. I was just constantly eaten up with worry. We were picturing him having left her out in the wilderness somewhere to freeze to death because he didn't want to kill her or something.
She kept talking to reporters and funneling information to the West Valley Police Department, telling them to look at Josh. She also started to suspect Josh might not have acted alone.
Yeah, and a few days into it, my husband and I were just lying in bed, and it was something like 12 or 1 or 2 in the morning, and we were just lying there, and neither of us had said anything for a long time, and I didn't even know if he was still awake. And I was just lying there thinking, oh, where is she? Where is she? What could have happened? We've got to find her. It's so cold. And my husband said out of the blue, what if it's Josh's dad? He's been obsessed with her for so long. What if it's Josh's dad? What if he convinced Josh to take her and give her to him? And that would get her out of Josh's hair, and then he'd finally have the wish that he's wanted for all these years.
Josh's own sister, Jennifer Graves, shared a similar fear. Susan had told Jennifer all about how Steve Powell had confessed his love for her back in 2003. Jennifer told the police her dad was a slithering snake with a slick tongue and could not be trusted. She also told Detective Ellis Maxwell she thought her brother was responsible for Susan's disappearance.
For me, it just kind of summed it up. Like, this guy's definitely involved. He's definitely responsible.
As Ellis was puzzling over the drugs in Susan's medicine cabinet and Josh was draining Susan's retirement, a pair of detectives were in Washington State. Gavin Cook and John LeFevre had gone there to speak with Josh and Susan's families, as well as their old friends. They were especially interested in talking to Steve. He agreed to meet with the detectives at the South Hill Library. The detectives recorded their conversation.
Basically, why we're here today, Steve, is to just get an idea of your thoughts, your relationship with Josh, and your knowledge of Josh and Susan's relationship, and just kind of build this puzzle and put it together, and just so we have information.
Steve described Josh and Susan's early marriage struggles. He said he thought Susan was conflicted about her faith. He confessed his own falling away from their religion and claimed Susan being a Latter-day Saint led to her repressing her sexual desires. Steve said there were times he could sense a kind of vibe from Susan, almost an electric current. Detective Cook wanted specifics. Steve made reference to 2002, when Josh and Susan were living in his home.
I mean, this seemed very happy to be around me, too, among other things, which always pleased me, because, I mean, she's the mother of my grandchildren. She's a beautiful young lady, you know.
Did she ever make any comments to you specifically? Or
not at all.
Was physically, did she touch you, or, you know that way, that goes along with those... Maybe the dynamics or the vibe that you were getting.
That was a tough one to really talk about. I mean, it really, I don't know, I think I'm going to pass on that question.
Okay. Yeah.
So Steve didn't want to talk about it. But Detective LaFavor came back to it a few minutes later.
Okay. But there was some talk about a possible, some kind of relationship between you and Susan. And so, obviously, we want to talk about that and see if there's a possibility. Daryl's kind of touching on it. There's a possibility that she may have left for another man that we don't know about. Or if there's a relationship between you and Susan, if there's some kind of possibility of her leaving Utah, coming up here, spending time with you.
Yeah, I'd love that. I mean, seriously, you know, John, I loved her dearly as a daughter. I loved her dearly as a woman. I mean, she's beautiful, and yeah, I was conflicted about her too. I will admit that.
Steve just couldn't help but admit his sexual desire for Susan. His missing daughter-in-law. Once that was in the open, he gushed. It was as if a dam had burst.
I was conflicted about her, and it was because of all that stuff that started when she moved there. I had never had any interest in her. She moved in with me. That's when that kind of thing started. She started that whole thing of the, you know, feel my legs and sitting down in chairs like that, you know, with her. You know what I mean? And it was a pretty constant barrage. I mean, pretty constant. And it continued, and it peaked eventually. I'm really not talk about that. But eventually, after it peaked, I actually confessed to her that I loved her because they were planning on moving to Utah. And I did not want her to move to Utah. I hoped that there was enough feeling there that she would stay. And she got really upset at me. She would not talk to me for months. It was the worst thing I ever did. And it was so troubling. And after those 3 or 4 months or whatever it was, then finally when they got ready to actually move out of state or whatever, I don't remember all the details. Then, you know, I went over there to help her move, and she finally came out of the room. And she really, really didn't talk much after that, but she was at that point friendly. But it was still still obvious to me that the electricity was there. You know what I'm saying? I mean, I could see things she was doing. You know what I mean? It's not like you can ignore things like that. I mean, I'm a male. She's a female. You know, and when she one job she worked at, she was introduced me to. They were
at the
retirement home.
She was
introduced me to Josh's brothers.
Well, you know, yeah, we're all guys here, and you know, I think we can all understand exactly what you're saying. We're probably all been in a similar situation.
Yeah.
All of the chatter the police had heard about Steve from Susan's friends suddenly came into sharp focus. Steve told the detectives Josh was unaware of the chemistry between himself and Susan.
And again, I don't mean to embarrass you, but we talked a little bit about the chemistry, the infamous confession.
Yeah.
Was there any sexual contact or any sexual relationship between you and Susan? I'm sorry to be blunt, but, you know, what other way to ask?
We never have actual, you know, like vaginal sex or anything like that, no.
Okay. Any kissing or touching or...
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
There was some of that.
What was that? I'm sorry. But.
Well, one night she wanted me to massage her feet and her legs and so on because she had been standing up a lot.
that day, and I did it, and I of course moved her feet to my cross so she could feel what she was doing to me, and then that went on for about an hour.
Okay.
So that kind of touching and feeling, and then she asked me to do her back, and I sat behind her, and rubbed myself against her for about an hour or two. That went on for about an hour.
Okay.
She got up at one point, and I don't know what she was doing, but I also handled her breasts and so on. I went under her shirt and handled her breasts. And that's about it.
She's not opposed to this.
Steve said Susan did once ask him what he was doing putting his hands on her. He'd quickly pulled away, but told the detectives he should have ignored her comment because she hadn't actually said the word no.
Back and forth. Did she reciprocate? Did she touch you with her hand?
No.
Okay.
No.
She just let you.
She just let me enjoy her. Her curves and whatever. Yeah, that was about it.
Okay, did you guys kiss, or did you kiss her?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Was it a single time?
That was kind of the peak of our relationship. It was a single time, and after that, there were some other things that were just tamer than that. Let's put it this way, they were tamer than that. And a lot of it had to do with just, my taking pictures of her and taking clothes.
Steve told the detectives he'd encouraged Josh to move back to Washington after Susan disappeared 10 days earlier. He had already suggested Josh sell their Sarah Circle house. The detectives, though, were more interested in Steve's house.
I think it would be irresponsible if we didn't at least ask your permission to double check with you to make sure Susan isn't with you. You know what I mean?
John, she is not with me.
And
I think if you talk to my friends, they know that I'm practically despondent about her disappearance.
Right.
Worried, sick. I would love, John, if she were with me, I would not do this to my son. If she were with me, I wouldn't have that. I would have said, she's with me.
Steve's word wasn't going to do it. They wanted his permission to take a look inside his home themselves.
We go to the house, we look to verify that she's not there, and that allows us to close this door.
That makes sense to me.
You've been great, guys. Very cooperative. Very awesome. I think that would be very beneficial to us. And I think that, again, I don't want you to think that we think that's what happened, because I don't think that that's the case. Okay? Can you take a minute?
In case you can't tell, Steve is crying here.
No, you're fine. You're fine. This is emotional.
We don't need to stir up old feelings either. That's not our intentions.
Was I so wishing she was there?
Between sobs, he invited, practically urged, the detectives to go search. Cook and Lefevre were, it seemed, surprised by the candor.
I'm almost putting myself in your shoes, and I'll be frank with you. You're in love with Susan, and I think you have been for a while. And I think when you feel that way towards somebody, you would do anything to help them, no matter where they're at or what might have happened to them. I mean, you have feelings that are deep for her, and I can feel that from you. And I can appreciate that. And those feelings might be able to help us. I mean,
yeah, if they can help you out, if there's something I can do, I will help.
They had one last favor to ask. Could Steve please ride over to the house with them, not in his own minivan? They didn't want to give him a chance to call ahead, warning Susan or someone else from the family to get her out of sight. But it didn't matter. Susan was not there. On the next episode of Cold.
Josh's like, if it was me, have you ever been out to the West Desert? There's mines everywhere. Nobody's going to find anything out there.
If you haven't already, please subscribe to Cold. Toss us a rating or a review. You can find Cold on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at The Cold Podcast. For video clips, pictures from the case, and more, hit up thecoldpodcast.com. Also, if Susan's story sounds familiar in your own life, in other words, if you or someone you know is experiencing domestic abuse in any form, please get immediate help. In the U.S., support is a phone call away at the National Domestic Violence Hotline at 1-800-799-7233 or online at www.thehotline.org. A quick thank you to my team, Kristen Sorensen, Eric Openshaw, Ken Fall, Danielle Prager, Adam Mason, Jillian Friedman, and especially Cheryl Worsley for all of their help with this project. The music for Cold was composed by Michael Bonmiller, except for the guitar stuff. That was me. Cold is a KSL podcast. Thank you for listening.
Let's jump into Peppa's world of play. Look for spring flowers, hunt for muddy puddles, and bravely explore exciting places with Peppa play sets. Peppa Pig, inspiring kid confidence.